Good morning, and welcome to Greater Good. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, from the Sun Sounds of Arizona Studios. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being, and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good magazine. Why do so many women go to prison after surviving domestic violence? A new book investigates how the U.S. criminal justice system targets survivors of domestic violence to prosecute them for fighting back. By Hope Reese, July 6, 2026. Nearly one in three women in prison who were charged with murder or manslaughter report experiencing domestic violence, according to journalist Justine Vanderlyn's survey of incarcerated women. But the true number is likely much higher. Yet, America's criminal justice system rarely recognizes abuse as a central part of women's pathways to prison. In Unreasonable Women, Vanderloon follows three women whose experiences challenge familiar narratives about crime, punishment, and victimhood. Through years of dogged reporting, court records, and interviews, she traces how domestic violence, childhood trauma, poverty, and systemic failures shaped the choices these women made and the harsh sentences many received. I spoke with Vanderloon over Zoom about criminalized survivors, the limits of self-defense law, and what it would take to create a more just system. Here is our interview, condensed and edited for clarity. Hope Reese, you set out to discover how many women in U.S. prisons fall in this category of criminalized survivors. What drove you to research this yourself? Justine Vanderloon. I was reading a report called The Sexual Abuse to Prison Pipeline by an organization called the Human Rights Project for Girls, looking at the way that girls and in particular black girls who were in the juvenile justice system had been sexually abused, often severely, before being incarcerated. I was really interested in this idea of punishment, this further state punishment for this thing that had happened. But it was really hard to report on kids, to get permission, especially kids who don't have parents. So I abandoned that. I just didn't know how to get in. Then I learned about the idea of survived and punished, from the group Survived and Punished. I ended up on Nikki's case, and then I created this whole ridiculous project. In retrospect, what was I thinking? To find out how many criminalized survivors there are now. Hope Reese, what did you learn? How many respondents reported experiencing abuse before entering the prison system? Justine Vanderloon. There have been studies that show that in certain facilities, up to 94% of women in prison have histories of domestic or sexual violence. And anecdotally, I never really talked to somebody who didn't. It's almost everybody. My research shows that 30% of respondents are criminalized survivors, and that's probably like a vast undercount because I didn't prime them. I didn't ask specifically, are you a criminalized survivor? Or did you experience abuse or violence? One thing that I cannot know is how many women get off. How many times do prosecutors not charge? If you don't get convicted, there's no record of anything. So if a woman did, say, defend herself, and they chose not to press charges or try and they fail, then there's really no way for me to find out that person, to find that person, and then look at their characteristics and compare them. Everything is down to these individual DAs for the most part. Hope Reese. A recurring question when it comes to these women and other victims of abuse is, why didn't she leave? Can you address this? Justine Vanderloon. It's a natural question that people who haven't lived through this have. People think, well, if someone's raping me, strangling me, putting me on Pornhub or whatever, I would just go. Anyone who's been through it, though, knows that you can't. It's the simplest answer, looking at these situations, is that it's not about if she decides to leave. It's about if he lets her leave. So the decision is not really the survivor's, the victim's decision. It's always the decision of the abuser. We put the onus on her to leave, but in almost every single case that I've looked at, she wants to leave. But in domestic violence situations, the person being abused is so intricately aware of their abuser's triggers and how they will react to everything. They know what will happen if they do. It's not like you can make the free choice to just walk out. Furthermore, as Nikki said to me once, if he had thrown me on the ground and raped me the first date, I wouldn't have been with him. But the abuse is so gradual. Also, when people have children and when people have lives together, it becomes so hard to disentangle yourself from these people who've also convinced you that you're worth nothing. Gemma is one of the women in my book. She said it doesn't matter how strong you are. It doesn't matter what a badass you think you are. If somebody, day after day, isolates you and tells you that you're a terrible mother, you're going to lose your children, you're worth nothing, nobody will want you, you start to believe it. An abuser isolates you or identifies someone who is already isolated and then gloms onto them. And when kids are involved, women wonder, how do I extract my child? Will he come for my child? Will the state come for my child? How do I remove my child from this life that they have with their dad? Tanisha, she wanted to leave, but she would have been homeless if she did. So she stayed while trying to get her life together. And it's not really a free choice. It's like the other choices, like sleeping in your car, you know, are untenable. For the other three women, everything that happened occurred when someone had left or was trying to leave. That's the most dangerous time. Hope Reese. Of children who have been abused, 77% face abuse in adulthood. Can you talk about how you observe this pattern in the women that you wrote about? Justine Vanderloon. I haven't been able to untangle it to the degree that I would like to. One expert said that the way that they deal with trust is profoundly altered. They either trust too much or they don't trust at all. The compass guiding them is a little broken. Tanisha had been abused so much as a child, she almost took it as a given that a man would do this to her. She was abused in all of her relationships. I don't know that she ever thought she was worth anything more or knew that she was worth not getting abused, because that was her only experience in life. Nikki's childhood abuse, in all cases actually, was never dealt with properly, so they couldn't find healing. It was denied or like swept under the rug, and when you don't heal from that, I don't know how you can go forward and create healthy relationships when you have sexual trauma, stuff that you never got treatment for. Even people who get treatment find it really hard to have healthy relationships later. So people who live on the margins have a lot of self-hate, shame, and worthlessness that they carry. Abusers are often really good at identifying that and coming into the lives of people like that as well. Hope Reese. And violence isn't always registered by the person experiencing it. Gemma, for example, had been thrown against a glass coffee table that shattered, but she didn't note it as abuse. Why do you think this happens? Justine Vanderloon. She told me that year was good. Gemma would say that first she loved him and she got involved, and then he was abusive. The more I looked at it, the more I saw that he forced her into the relationship and the marriage by strangulation and abuse, and by tracking her and stalking her. But because she felt that there was an inevitability to it, she may have tried to create in her mind a more pleasant reality in which she was choosing this and loved him. Because the alternative was that she was being forced and raped and strangled into a relationship. I think she wrote off a lot of things because she kind of had to live her life and to keep going, including the coffee table incident. She had created a bit of an alternate reality. Hope Reese. Beginning in the 1970s, lawyers defending or helping women with cases of criminalized survival advised them to plead insanity rather than self-defense. Why is self-defense so difficult to prove? Justine Vanderloon. I called the book Unreasonable Women because for a long time, the jury was tasked with deciding if a defendant acted as a hypothetical, reasonable man would have acted. They were supposed to put themselves in the person's shoes and answer, would a reasonable person have done the same, knowing the same things, having the same fears? There was never really a reasonable woman. It later was turned to the reasonable person standard. So self-defense has typically been conceived of as the idea of like two men outside of a bar, equally sized, having a fight. Would a reasonable man in that situation have reacted thusly? A woman in a domestic violence situation, what is reasonable to her, knowing what she knows, is quite different. Then there's the issue of imminence in self-defense. The threat had to be so imminent that you had to react with force. It's often required that it be in the exact second in hand-to-hand combat. But if it were hand-to-hand combat, women would usually die. She won't be able to defend herself. So imminence looks different for women, and that's rarely considered historically and legally. Hope Reese, how is Tanisha's story an example, a prime example of criminalized survival? Justine Vanderloon, Tanisha was dealing with not having housing. She ended up meeting a guy at a club, and he had a room, and she didn't want to sleep in a car, and she didn't want to impose on friends. She ended up going and moving in with him. He wasn't her boyfriend, he was just a roommate, but he abused her. Quickly, he took over her life. She wanted to leave, but he also took over her finances, so she couldn't leave very easily. So she decided she didn't want to sleep in the car so she could make it work while she stayed. Then he killed a man in their shared apartment. She was there at the time. She ran out. He put a gun to her head. He put a hand to her throat. And he basically told her to get with the program and do as he said, or he would kill her as well. She did as he said. She helped wrap the body of this young man that he had killed. Then she ran for years. She was really scared of him. She was scared of the police. Finally, her conscience got to her. She came forward to help solve this old cold case and help the police so that his family could have closure. Hope Reese. She had faith that the system would protect her. What actually happened? Justine Vanderloon. Alyssa Beria says something like, Black women are used as pawns to demonstrate justice and then disposed of. I certainly saw that. If we consider justice convictions, which I think prosecutors often do, these women are often used to testify. Tanisha came forward, but she was promised immunity, according to her. She had a bad lawyer, and she didn't get it. They needed to build their case, they said, to make her believable to a jury. She couldn't have gotten any deal. They used her as a witness so that they could win their conviction, and so they threw her life away. Hope Reese. Efforts such as New York's Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act address criminalized survival. What would it take to overhaul the system? Justine Vanderloon. Survivor justice laws provide openings for people who are in prison to get their cases heard. Oklahoma, Illinois, New Jersey, and more recently Georgia have passed such laws. The laws allow for a person who can show that abuse was a significant contributing factor for the judge to have discretion on sentencing. They're also retroactive. So if you're in prison, you can have a chance of getting your case heard again. Those laws are really important, but I can't sugarcoat it. It's a systematic issue. I'm sorry, it's a systemic issue. It's generational. It's enslaved people who came before these women were born, and these ideas that people learned about these communities, what they've been through. It's clear that the narratives we're told about people and the labels that are put on them by the criminal legal system, prisons, even media, have nothing to do with who they are, the real context of their lives or what really happened. Some really remarkable people are locked up on murder convictions. It's changed how I understand being a woman in America. This is baked into our culture and society. It's what we all experience on some level. This is all by design. About the author. Hope Reese is a journalist based in Budapest, Hungary, who writes for the New York Times, The Atlantic, Vox, and many other publications. She is the author of The Women Are Not Fine. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, bringing you Greater Good Magazine. And next we have a Greater Good in Action practice. This one is called Life Crafting. How to do it. Time required, 20 minutes. Life crafting is a way to better define your goals in life and chart a path to achieving them. While honing your sense of purpose in life can feel daunting, this practice breaks it down into the following steps, a series of short writing prompts. Number one, identify your deepest values and passions. What's most important to you? Write a list of your greatest values and a separate list of what you most like to do in life. If you need help, write about the qualities you admire in others, skills you would like to build, or personal habits you both like and dislike. Two, reflect on your ideal future. Write a paragraph envisioning how you'd like your social life or your career path to turn out if you had no constraints. What do you want your ideal life to look like? What kinds of personal and professional relationships do you want to have? What do you want in an ideal job or volunteer experience? To help you elaborate on your passions, you can describe what kind of career you want or how you'd like to spend your time outside of work, either after hours or in retirement. Three, write down how you'll attain these goals. Prioritize your goals and, in another paragraph, identify obstacles in the way of those goals. Describe your strategy for overcoming those obstacles and explain how you will track your progress toward those goals. Four, make a public commitment to your goals. Communicate these goals to others in your community, including your friends, family, and coworkers. Why you should try it. Defining your sense of purpose in life can feel daunting or even overwhelming. This may be especially true after the COVID-19 pandemic, when so many of us lost the routines, people, places, and experiences that helped to give our lives meaning. This practice can sharpen our sense of purpose in life and break the process down into a series of more manageable steps. By encouraging us to reflect specifically on the values and activities that provide us with meaning and motivation, it can help to renew certain passions or help us to see new possibilities that were previously invisible to us. In the process, it can help us work through stressful situations with greater clarity and resolve. Why it works. Researchers define purpose as something that is both personally meaningful and socially valuable. By reflecting on your present and future life, this practice can help you make sense of your priorities in life, better articulate the values and passions that are important to you personally, and also possibly make a contribution to the wider world. It breaks down the search for purpose and meaning in life into concrete steps, making our goals and sources of meaning more salient to us. Past research suggests that people who find meaning and purpose in the aftermath of traumatic events tend to have better mental health. What's more, a substantial body of research suggests that writing about thoughts, feelings, and goals can help support mental health and goal attainment. You've been listening to Greater Good Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, thanking you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. And now, stay tuned for more interesting programming coming your way next from Sun Sounds of Arizona.